Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Telltale, A Small Town, Enduring Love, A Web of Secrets, by Claire Ashton, narrated by Lucy Rayner. Chapter 1. The country manor was so quiet that when Lady Sophie Melling opened her eyes, she could believe she was dead. The morning air chilled her cheeks, and the twilight hung paused before her first breath, as if she'd passed away in the night with no one to witness, and only silence to welcome it. But today, something, or someone, a definite sound, had woken her. She reached to the bedside table for her glasses, the oversized ones by Dior, whose chic style softened the blow of the beginnings of middle-aged eyesight. Her surroundings sharpened into criss-crossing lines of blossom on the wallpaper. Empty. Her cavernous room and bed were devoid of company, as usual. She almost called out, "Daniel?" But the silence prickled, and she held her tongue. Sophie slipped from her bed, her silk pajamas flowing into perfect lines, and crept across the room. She pointed her toes with precise control from ballet lessons and deportment classes. If she'd been thinking, she would have found it amusing the purpose she'd put her training to. All that money her parents had spent on refining and defining their daughter. She slipped her finger between the velvet curtains, and a sliver of dull winter light intruded. The turning circle below was empty, except for a deep trail in the gravel from Daniel's Porsche, betraying his rush to escape the middle of Wales at the weekend. The sun hadn't risen yet above the mountains, and the brown moors loomed over the manor and grounds. Warm rays would only reach the house by midday this early in December, before hiding again behind the hills. The village further down the valley did better, although a blanket of fog cloaked it today. Then she saw them. Footprints. A black trail across the frozen grass, regular and small from this distance, like animal tracks. They emerged from the mist, scratched across the lawns, and marked all the way up the stone steps to the front door. The prints, large, and perhaps from a boot, scuffed the frost of the top step. And there they stopped. Did someone stand out of sight? She peered down the outside wall of the Georgian manor to the front door. Shut, with no one there.
Daniel,
she called out this time, unnerved. Then she wished she hadn't. Her voice broke the stasis of the house, and she grew vulnerable, as if everything turned its focus on her. It had been stupid. He'd be the last person to approach from the village. There was no use pretending now. She threw her dressing gown around her shoulders and called out from the landing. Her crystal voice echoed around the house. She stamped down the stairs, the deep clatter on the dark oak reverberating beneath her feet. It was intentional. Shoulders squared, like Daddy always told her, and a confident stride to appear fearless, like she owned the place, which she did now, of course, since the old bastard died last year.
"Hello? Daniel?"
she called out. She entertained the ridiculous idea of fetching a poker from the grand fireplace of the drawing room, before turning instead to another reception room and private space of her husband. She nudged her toe at the door, which swung open to reveal a garish interior. His boudoir, for the want of a better term. While the rest of the ground floor kept its centuries-old style, this was her husband's alone. The glass-top coffee table, square and boxy forum sofas, the yellow ochre rug, wallpaper a riot of pattern and colour. She shuddered like she had when he redecorated. Daniel had raised a martini and said, "Good God, Sophie, move with the times, darling. This is the 1970s.
I am moving with the times,
she'd always insist, feeling anything but ready for the new decade. The 60s seemed a blur.
What? That floral throwback wallpaper you're smothering the bedrooms in?
Laura Ashley is an excellent designer and local to Wales. I want to support her.
Daniel spat out a laugh.
Why? What the hell have the locals done to deserve that?
Daddy would expect...
Your daddy is dead. She could have said the same with venom, but it always hurt whenever it came from someone else. No Daniel here this morning, though. 3 empty martini glasses on the tabletop, a tumbler, and an empty bottle of whiskey in a pool of sticky liquid which she didn't want to examine more closely. But no husband. He was unlikely to be anywhere else in the house, not without poking his nose into her bedroom first to tell her he was back. Then what was that noise? It had been a hard sound, like a door clicking to, but with a muted distance to it. She stood in the great hallway, listening, the gentle tock of the grandfather clock cracking the silence at regular intervals. Nothing surfaced in between the punctuated passage of time, and the house stood, waiting, as rigid as Sophie, so that its presence grew and tension crawled up her back. The house was vast, so many places for someone to tuck themselves away. Another generous reception room and library, passageway to the kitchen and pantry, washroom, 6 bedrooms upstairs, the master bedroom for Daniel, hers the secondary, out of choice, 2 rooms for children they didn't have, and 2 guest suites, and a whole attic space that spanned the entire upper floor. She peered up at the small hatch in the ceiling at the top of the stairs. What was up there? Things she had forgotten. Things yet to be discovered. A place where things could hide.
Lady Melling?
Jesus Christ!
The words shot from her lips, and her shoulders leapt. Sophie swirled round. A dark shape stalked the passageway to the service rooms. Skinny legs in brown tights that wrinkled all the way to the open toes of a pair of mules. Black nylon dress. Checked tabard. The pale face scowled, even though it was pulled tight by grey hair in a bun. Sophie had worked herself into such a state that she took several seconds to believe the shape that had emerged from the passage was benign. Or at least familiar.
Miss Howells!
She gasped.
You frightened the life out of me.
She palmed her chest.
Caris,
she corrected herself. Sophie was no longer a child. She was mistress of the manor now.
You're early.
He said to come in, Caris replied, her rural Welsh accent clipped. By he, she meant Sophie's husband, and that Caris never used his title said so much.
Told me he'd left the place in a bit of a state and wanted it tidy for you.
The housekeeper squeezed her hands into fists by her sides, as if ready to spring into fight or flight. The twitch was habitual. She'd done it for years. Even from 3 decades ago, Sophie remembered that mannerism. Caris must have looked younger back then, surely. But Sophie's memory insisted on the same shape, hair, and clothing. And the scowl, that was enduring.
Did he indeed?
Sophie inhaled deeply.
Well, that's very kind of you to change your schedule.
Caris refrained from commenting. The servant came from another time, when the manor had maids, a cook, a butler, and several gardeners. There was much left unsaid this morning. If anyone had asked why Caris had been called in, or what was left in the second reception room, or how much time the couple of the house spent together, she would reply, as Sophie had often overheard.
Not my place to say, is it?
Caris was one of the few locals she trusted, as far as Sophie trusted anyone. Decades of steady service and honored employment meant something, she hoped. Caris would know which side her Barabrith was buttered. After an uncomfortable passage of time, Caris said stoically, I best be getting on. Sophie nodded before calling out,
Caris, when did you arrive?
Just now, your ladyship.
You came straight in, right this minute.
Thank you, Sophie said with a nod, and her shoulders dropped with relief. It must have been Caris, that's all. And with the dismissal, the woman faded back into the passageway. Sophie breathed out. The servant clattered in the kitchen, and with the crack of crockery and clang of saucepans, the threat of the house seemed to recede with the echoes of normal daytime routine. It was brighter outside, and shadows in the hallway faded, revealing nothing but empty nooks. Sophie held the rail and hauled herself upstairs, tired by the panic and rude awakening. Then it occurred to her that Caris, in almost 40 years, had never arrived using the front door, and her mules wouldn't have left those hefty footprints on the doorstep. Sophie opened her bedroom door and spotted a piece of paper on the dressing table. A small cream notelet folded in two. That hadn't been there before. Whether it was from last night or this morning, it certainly wasn't Sophie's. She stretched out and pinched the note from its place, as if it were contagious or might pounce. She opened it, as carefully as prizing apart a butterfly's wings, cautious about what lay inside. The message was written in large, cursive writing. The hand must have been unsteady because the lines trembled, but the inky message was clear. Liar. And Sophie dropped the note, as if it were a flame.
Chapter 2.
Well, I never. That sounds like Beth and Harris. The woman's voice drifted through the fog that had curled cold fingers into every corner of the village this morning. It faded the churchyard walls to a pale grey and the church almost invisible on the grassy mound at the centre of the village. The timber-framed houses along the road were diminished, as were the footsteps of the woman who stomped down the road towards Beth and her daughter. The shape could have been any number of women in the village. A halo of curled and set ginger hair, overcoat, robust shoes, tartan shopping trolley trundling behind. But it was the voice of only one, whom Beth recognized as Glynis Gittens. She had a face that reminded Beth, and she always felt guilty about this, of a ruddy cauliflower, one with tiny, shrewd eyes. Glynis was a friendly woman who always took an interest in everyone's lives, which was what put Beth on guard this morning.
It is you. Thought I recognized your voice coming out of Station House, said Glynis,
less substantial in the fog than usual, and with tiny jewels of water decorating the curls of her hair. Perhaps she noticed Beth's gaze, or her daughter's. Children were never subtle, and she patted at her curls with her fingertips.
Should have worn my scarf today. Rushed out I did.
Barada, Mrs. Gittens, Beth said.
She gulped down her anise to pretend a calm that was usually natural. She tried to block the recent tension from making its way to her fingers that held her preteen daughters. Glynis leant back, making a large double chin, and chuckled.
Oh, you need to call me by my Christian name now you're all grown up.
Beth nodded, sustaining her smile, even though the idea sat uncomfortably.
Well, this must be your lovely daughter I hear so much about, Glynis said.
Again, Beth twitched, and she channeled the movement into an affectionate squeeze of her daughter's hand.
I can't believe this is the tiny baby I last saw.
Say hello, darling,
Beth said.
Good morning. I mean, bore da, Mrs. Gittens,
Nia replied.
Oh, bah.
Glynis put a palm over her heart.
You're learning the language, There's not many newcomers who bother.
You see, go up Llanerval way, and you find children who don't speak a word of English until they start school. People from England don't seem to appreciate that. And she buttoned her lips on the last word, as if to stop any further opinions on that land.
Tide's got you learning, hasn't he?
Beth said. One of the many things Beth's father had insisted on, stamping his authority over her choices.
And you'll have lessons at school.
Times are changing, aren't they?
Glynis said. When I was at school, some still threatened us with the Welsh knot if we spoke our language in lessons. It was inevitable that Nia would hear tales from the older teachers of the wooden board of shame worn around the neck, inscribed with WN. The placard was passed on, and the last one caught talking Welsh caned at the end of the day. Beth was about to reassure Nia that the Welsh knot was long gone, when Glynis cheerily moved on.
Practice is the key.
Glynis leant down, though she needn't. Nia was a tall girl already. Her blonde hair, pulled in a neat plait, mirrored her mother's, which had darker tendrils from age. They both wore woolen coats and A-line skirts, Nia's school grey and Beth's corduroy, with long leather boots for the woman and long white socks and black patent leather T-bar shoes for the girl. Both in uniforms of sorts.
If you need any Welsh conversation, Glynis continued, you come and chat with me. You ask your mam. I can talk the hind legs off a donkey.
Beth laughed, too loudly.
And I shouldn't be calling you a newcomer anyway, should I?
Glynis pulled up straight and lifted puffy florets of brow.
Knew your mam here since she was a baby, and your Nine and Tide have lived in Voyle all their lives. You're part of the place already.
The familiarity squirmed in Beth's stomach. Glynis reached forward and squeezed Nia's shoulder, and Beth was relieved to see her daughter smile with a confidence that had become impossible for Beth. So, how is your mom? Glynis turned more serious to Beth.
Another tired day, Beth said, nodding.
It's so good of you to come home and look after her. Isn't your mom good, Bach?
Nia swung Beth's arm. Her daughter's obvious pride pinched at Beth's heart and released another wave of guilt.
And after your dad, too, Glynis continued. Busy man, you're tight, she said again to Nia. Sergeant Griffiths takes care of us, doesn't he?
That made Nia smile as well, although Beth couldn't share the pride.
And so close to Christmas, Glynis rumbled on. I bet your mam's relieved in her condition. Hard enough taking care of your dad at the best of times, but with Christmas coming and her being ill-like. Oh, you're a good girl. You always were, Beth. But I bet your poor husband's missing you. Is he coming up to visit?
There it was, the reference Beth had been guarding against, but had failed to prepare for.
Maybe,
Beth stuttered, tripped up by the mention of her husband and the rare opportunity to get a word in edgeways.
Oh, that's nice. Is he coming up weekends to see you all?
Is Dad coming?
Nia said, with an all-too-excited smile.
No. Sorry, darling.
The familiarity of it all had hurtled them to this point.
I don't know when he can.
I bet he's busy,
Glynis said without missing a beat. I heard he's heading up a big investigation, which had been a saving grace more than once.
He is, Nia said. How did you know? How does everybody know?
Nia added with a little wrinkle at the top of her nose. Glynis chuckled.
No one has secrets round here, Cariad. It's not like Leicester. I bet no one knows who's next door there.
We're by the Siddiqui's.
Nia replied.
Well, there you go.
Glynis smiled. It was forced.
Well, round here you'll know your neighbours and their neighbours' neighbours and all their cousins, I tell you. We all know each other's business here.
which was what Beth was afraid of. Glynis left with an obligatory, "Well, I best be getting on." The women of Voyle were always in the middle of something, and Beth and Nia pushed through the gate.
"Shortcut through the churchyard," Beth said.
Nia beamed up at her, and not for the first or hundredth time did Beth's heart skip with the love for her child. In all of this, she was grateful for her daughter, who seemed untouched by it all. The narrow path clawed its way up the hill towards the church, ancient graves and crosses of local stone leaning over its entire length.
"Look at that one,"
Nia said, stopping to point at an ornate grey block as tall as her.
"There's a whole family here."
Nia picked at a crust of yellow lichen to reveal lettering. Beth struggled with the urge to chastise her daughter for tampering with the gravestone. But wouldn't they have wanted the stone to be red? And by the time Beth had sorted her moral quandary, the moment had passed, and Nia had moved on to another grave. This was Beth's brain at the moment, torn by indecision and crumbling confidence.
"This one's tiny,"
Nia said. It marked the spot of a family the same size, but perhaps less well off. Beth couldn't help twitching at the familiarity of the grave.
"We used to play here, you know."
"Who?"
"Me and my friends."
Beth hadn't talked about her youth. Nia would probably find it strange her mother having best friends as a girl. She probably thought it weird her mother had ever been a teen.
"We used to put a coin on the top."
Nia wrinkled her nose in confusion. "There's an old wives' tale that if you put a coin on a gravestone and dance around it 12 times, a ghostly hand will reach out and take the money." Nia's eyes went wide.
"Really? Did you try it? Does it work?"
"We did try," Beth said, drawn in by Nia's fascination and the memory. "It was at night. Full moon, too. There were three of us." Beth reached into her coat pocket for her small coin purse and a silver shilling, the new fivepence piece. She placed it on the gravestone, its milled edges scraping the stone, and it clinked as she dropped it flat. Beth hesitated with a tremor at the prospect that a ghost could reach out and grab her, that the past would extend its chilling reach into the present.
"Don't do it,"
Nia giggled with eyes wider still.
"I won't if you don't want me to. But do you want to know what happened?"
Nia nodded.
"We danced, all three of us."
Beth circled the grave as she spoke. 12 times round. Faster and faster. Beth could sense the swirl and thrill of the dance and the presence of her friends.
"And then?"
"Nothing happened. Nothing like it ever again." That had been the last time they'd been together. Beth stared at the stone. Her head spun at the memory, so that rows of gravestones surrounding them seemed to move. The feeling of turning back those 20 years was so strong that she swayed on her heels.
"Are you all right, Mum?"
Nia asked.
"Fine, just a little dizzy."
Beth tried to laugh it off.
Like the world was turning and nothing would stay in its place.
Beth focused and the gravestone settled. All except one that walked away. Beth blinked.
"Jesus Christ,"
she gasped. Beth stared at a dark shape hunched into the curve of a gravestone. It slipped behind another, and for a moment Beth thought she'd imagined it. Then it seeped out again, moving round as smooth as liquid behind a tomb. Beth swallowed to find her voice.
"Nia?"
She reached out her hand.
"Dahama."
Her nervous relapse into Welsh confused her daughter, and Beth had to think how to translate.
"Nia, come here,"
she stuttered. The child went straight to her side.
"What is that, Mum?"
Nothing to worry about, I'm sure. But I want you closer. Nia looked in the direction of the dark body.
Isn't that the woman we saw in the street?
I think so. Beth was reasonably sure it was a woman under the rags. She attempted to balance mature and generous benefit of the doubt against an instinct to shield Nia.
Tide said she was all right,
Nia said, although her expression asked for reassurance now. Beth and Nia had seen her when they were out shopping at Mace, on the corner, a shapeless mass asleep on the pavement, and a coat, scarf and dress on closer look. Long, dirty grey hair obscured pallid skin, grey with ill health. Beth wished she was like the other villagers, apparently used to the old woman's presence. And it seemed only Beth was troubled by her.
Old Hetty,
Nia whispered, her voice dying in the thick air.
That's what Tide called her. He said she was harmless.
Was it harmless or homeless? Beth couldn't recall. She wondered at her daughter's faith in her father. But people did that, trusted the senior police officer of the village, and Beth held her daughter tight, hoping she was right.
Tide said she's been around forever, Nia continued. She used to stay with someone called Trevor in a broken caravan.
Yes, Beth said, happier for Nia to be reassured. But Hetty wasn't here 20 years ago when Beth left home. Hetty had appeared in Beth's absence, and this old, frankly terrifying woman was part of Voyle now. Some things had changed in the years in between, like Beth's grandparents buried in the ground that seemed to mark the natural and relentless passage of time. But others, like this, seemed a sign of things wrong in the world. Nia frowned in question at Beth. I don't like seeing homeless folk here, Beth managed. Doesn't seem right in Voyle. For some reason, Beth expected the sight in Leicester or London, but it seemed a more malignant symptom in the Welsh hills. What did this old Hetty do with Trevor and his caravan before he died? The poor sod who came back from the war, not quite the same. But nobody talked about it, not in a way that helped.
Looks like she's leaving, Nia said.
The hunched figure flowed onto the path, and they watched her fade without a sound down the hill. Then the figure turned, and even though the fog meant Beth had no hope of making out old Hetty's eyes, she felt their gaze as keenly as if the woman had slapped her. Chapter 3. That was something that hadn't changed. Council leader Bryn Thomas held court outside the lich gate of the churchyard, one hand in his slacks pockets, the other holding a polished pipe embedded beneath his moustache, feet spread apart as if he guarded the heart of the village. His hair hadn't changed, although its sleekness was now at odds with eyebrows that had grown bushy. The iron grey was swept back like Elvis's, old Elvis. The singer's style had moved on and embraced the 1970s, while Bryn's had not. The king, if he'd grown old in the Welsh hills and had a penchant for tweed. Bryn's belly emerged from beneath the flaps of his jacket, more than Beth remembered though, taut against a beige jumper, so that the outline of his tie protruded. Beth hesitated under the shelter of the roofed gate, dreading the inevitable recognition. But Bryn took a puff from his pipe and jabbed it towards a woman in the crowd.
Well now,
he said, adjusting his tie, tight beneath a generous chin.
We shouldn't be too hasty.
Beth recognized the woman by sight, just one of the captivated crowd around the councillor. She wore cat-eye glasses from 20 years past, and a blue twin set beneath her knitted coat.
We need to give her time to settle in,
Bryn said.
But it's been months now,
the woman said, with a wobble of outrage.
It has.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?